Greetings and welcome to Throttle Up. This is a radio show and a podcast that showcases critical thinking and complex problem solving. And the show is designed to inform, delimit, empower, and amaze. Now, all aboard the Throttle Up Express, powered by High Velocity Reason, and I am your host, Captain Kevin Smith, U.S. Navy retired, and I'm a naval aviator and a pioneer in the field of critical thinking, complex problem solving, and also High Velocity Reason. Now, our tagline for the show is to accelerate beyond the ordinary, and our motto is to employ high velocity reason to achieve high octane performance. And we have a mission statement for Throttle Up. Our mission statement for Throttle Up is to provide our listening audience with a relatively easy yet effective way to strengthen our power of reason through the employment of critical thinking. Our website is throttleupradio.com. That's throttleupradio.com. And, oh, by the way, that's important for a number of reasons, not least of which is that we post our radio shows on the website. And so you can, and so they are preserved as a podcast. So Throttle Up is a podcast now, as well as a radio show. And so you can download it on demand from the website and also from other podcast platforms. Let's see, a couple of more things for the introduction. Audio engineering services is provided by Evergroove Studios, and they are located in Evergreen, Colorado, and they keep the audio quality of this show top-notch, and they are a great group of folks to work with, and we've been working with them for some time now. Also, promotional material for Throttle Up and all the various aspects associated with this radio show, as well as my authorship in terms of the books that I have published and have a national distribution, is provided by Reflections Printing. They can be found on the website standouthandouts.com. That's standouthandouts.com. The gal is Jennifer. She does a great job for all businesses that need promotional material to promote your ideas, products, or services. I would highly recommend this organization. Phone number for Reflections Printing is 435-574-0422. That's 435-574-0422. Now, Throttle Up is typically organized into three parts. Part one is a continuing discussion of critical thinking, which we do every week, unless we have a special edition, and we do that from time to time. But a normal show will typically have three parts. Part one is critical thinking. Part two is our storyboard. And that is, in fact, as you would expect, a story of America, Americans, or whatever. And part three is a radio essay, which is a little bit more in-depth treatment of a particular subject. All right, almost done with the introduction. All aboard the Throttle Up Express. This is a place where all critical thinkers are welcome with open arms. Now, let us press on to part one. Okay, welcome back to part one of Throttle Up for this week. Part one is a continuing discussion of critical thinking. And today, we are going to be talking about how to critically examine an argument that is put forward by, in this particular case, the social justice warriors that favors collectivism, or another way of saying that is neo-Marxism and its offshoots, such as communism, socialism, national socialism, and so forth. So we are going to examine that. We're going to examine their argument. We have an opportunity to do so because of a recent event. So we're going to examine this argument from a critical thinking standpoint. How do we critically examine an argument? Any argument, right? So it doesn't necessarily have to be politically focused, although in this case it is, and it's useful for us as we examine this world of critical thinking and how it can be used effectively in our lives. Part two is a storyboard. And we'll get to that after part one. And this is a continuing story of politics in America. And this particular story is about the FBI spying on the Trump campaign. So we'll be talking about that in part two. And in part three, if we get to it, sometimes we have a little bit of trouble with with getting everything in. We try our best, but... I suppose I should probably learn a little bit more about time management anyway. Part three, if we get to it, is our radio essay. And this is a continuing discussion of something that we recently started. It's called complex problem solving. You know, what is it? Is it how is it related to critical thinking? And so we need to spend some quality time on that. And we will do so if we get to it in other things in the future. All right. So let us... press on to part one. Now, let me set the stage here as we begin our discussion of how to examine an argument from a critical thinking standpoint. Another way of saying that, of course, is how do we critically examine something? In this particular case, it's an argument or it's a proposition. And what got me thinking about this is a recent event that has occurred. It's called the Monk Debates, and that was being done somewhere, I think in Vancouver, British Columbia, somewhere in Canada. It might have been Toronto. I cannot remember, but anyway, so they had I think this was last Friday, they put on this Monk Debate, and it had, among other people in this debate, Jordan Peterson. Of course, Jordan Peterson now is an internationally known figure. He is probably the most influential psychologist / philosopher in our time right now, as it turns out. And he was debating some people on the left, although Jordan Peterson does not necessarily identify himself as a person on the right. But nevertheless, the debate was all about political correctness, and it kind of went this way as the debate organizers set it up: is political correctness social progress, or is it societal retrograde? So that was the question. And on Jordan Peterson's side, along with Stephen Fry, who is a noted author and comedian in Great Britain, they were both occupying the retrograde side. So political correctness is not social progress; it's suppression of human progress. And on the pro side of political correctness was two people. We're going to focus on the person, Michael Dyson. He was on the pro side of political correctness. Now, I didn't know much about Michael Dyson until I dove into this subject. He apparently is a commentator that occupies left-leaning TV programs and TV channels and stuff like that. Supposedly, he's a professor somewhere, but I do not know where it is. And he is American. He's also a minority. The Monk Debate, and here's my take on it. To set this thing up, my take on it is that the Monk Debate, which occurred last Friday, degenerated into an ad hominem attack by both liberal commentators against Jordan Peterson. So while the Monk debate was set up to explore political correctness, it degenerated into Jordan Peterson bashing, which was pretty unfortunate, although I guess you could say not unexpected. You would more or less be able to predict that if you understood how these socialist-leaning people conduct themselves. Now, the implied conclusion from the left is that we must revise the current socioeconomic system in order to correct these discussed morally reprehensible conditions. So the left-leaning commentators, as well as probably the bulk of the left socialists, if you will, that's pretty much their proposition. Now, my question is this: how to critically examine the arguments put forth by the adherents to collectivism, and that is contemporaneously called social justice warriors. Another term that describes this group or this group think is neo-Marxism. So the first thing I want to do is I want to set the stage. So I call this a first step in this critical examination process. I call it staging the critical examination. All right, so we're going to set the stage. It's also another frame, another term is a frame of reference. And that they're all good terms. So before you actually dive into something that is a little bit, a little bit tricky, it has a number of factors of associated with it. It's best to step back a little bit and establish some kind of a frame of reference by which we can engage in a reasoning process. So it's not advisable by me and other folks that are promoting this idea of critical thinking. It's not advisable to dive right into a particular problem without first establishing your frame of reference or setting the stage. So in setting the stage for this discussion, all right, the first thing is this: do not immediately jump into the argumentation phase. Instead, consider how is it that this argument is actually being put forth? Where does it come from? It just didn't just spontaneously arrive on the world stage. It had to have come from someplace. And that is a really good staging question for all of us. I don't do that all the time, but the times that I don't do that, I regret not doing that. It is so important to step back a little bit and ask yourself, how is it that this argument is occurring? The other thing is, does the argument contain a present or looming crisis or catastrophe? And you notice that the climate change argument always does this, always contains a looming crisis or catastrophe. And that ought to be a red flag for any one of us. The other thing is, does this argument that we are trying to examine attempt to carve out a morally superior position? And that's also a red herring. That's also a huge marker on the path of critical examination of a subject. Now, as we begin our investigation, let us also, not only in terms of this frame of reference, but we need to be a little bit more clear in our understanding of what is actually going on. So I call this a clarification of the cognitive space. All right, so anytime you have an argument, anytime you have a proposition being put forward, you have to consider it to be part of the cognitive space. It occupies a place in the intellectual world. It occupies a place, right? It's not a physical place, but it is a real place. It's a cognitive place. It's a space. Now, here I'm going to reference or refer to a gentleman by the name of Richard Feynman. And so I want to give him credit. I don't like to use things that I know were originally developed by others without giving them credit. And so I'm going to give Richard Feynman, and his last name is spelled T-H-I-E-M-E, and we have discussed him before on this show. And I'm going to give him credit for approaching this discussion from this perspective. So let me press on here with the clarification of the cognitive space. The cognitive arena, representing the mind of society, is the new battlefield, the use of soft power in the form and content pertaining to information warfare is being employed by certain forces to gain control of the mind of society. Mind control is the objective. The mind space is where the battle is being waged, and understanding this is essential if we are to employ effective countermeasures to overcome this global threat. Continuing with this train of thought, I will say the following concerning hostile agents. Hostile agents enter the battle space employing cognitive mechanisms designed to enhance the plausibility of a proposition, such as the unemployability of the descendants of slavery, and we'll get into that in a minute, that while beneficial to the cause of social justice, cannot objectively be justified using the power of reason. The post-slavery neo-Marxist argument put forward by Michael Dyson in this debate is as follows. Those races, and this is, I'm kind of paraphrasing a quote here by this liberal. Actually, it's more than a liberal. He's a social justice warrior and a spokesperson for the left. Those, I'm more or less quoting him here. Those races held in slavery, he says, for over 300 years have recently been set free. But, and here's the kicker. But since they have never developed the necessary skills, I would say parenthetically, that's a plausible proposition, but hang on to that thought. Let me continue. They have no skills that can support a living wage. That's his proposition. I know. I'll continue here. This lack of skill acquisition, he goes on to say, is the result of neo-capitalism, and it keeps these people, these descendants of slavery, in a continuous state of oppression. Implied and contained within this argument is, consequently, this is yet another example of a minority group, which includes blacks, people of color, First Nation descendants, being exploited by white male privilege. I'm continuing with his proposition. This opposition, he goes on to say, which is morally reprehensible, can only be rectified by sweeping socioeconomic changes within the culture. Now, what you see here, the first thing about bringing clarity to the discussion of the argument. The first thing is to see if, in fact, the argument or the argumentors are evoking virtue. All right, that's the first thing. Now, look at it objectively, all right, but with caution now, all right? So we're going to apply some reasonable levels of caution, but we're going to see if, one, the argumentors, if that's a word, the people that are they're proposing this proposition, are they evoking virtue? All right, and if the answer is yes, they are, okay, they are carving out for themselves this self-appointed place, which is a higher moral ground. Okay, so have they done that? The answer is yes. All right, so the first thing is to look at what I call the virtue tree. What part of the virtue tree are they holding on to? What branch of the tree of virtue are they holding on to? Now, as a historical footnote here, before we answer this question, Marxism or communism was built on the foundation of the grievance of the age, namely the socioeconomic class distinction between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. Bourgeoisie are the owners of the means of production, and the proletariat are the workers without ownership of the means of production. All right, so that was the historical foundation for Marxism or communism. So is the argument putting forth or contained within the proposition virtue, or are they evoking virtue? And if the answer is probably yes, let's find out what part of the virtue tree are they hanging on to or pointing to. Is it compassion? Is it sentimentality? Is it altruism? Is it generosity? Is it equality? Is it group rights? Is it minimum wage? Is it free health care? Is it environmentalism or the eradication of child hunger? And I could go on, but you get my point. All right. And this is a really great exercise if you would, you know, create your own virtue tree and sort of like use that. All right. Save it somewhere in your computer or save it in your notes or your diary, which is what I do, by the way, and refer to that or use that to try to come to grips with a particular argument or proposition. Are they evoking virtue? And if they are, how are they doing that? Okay, so that's the virtue tree. Now, reparations, all right, this argument putting forth by Michael Dyson also implies reparations for past human rights abuses are an important part of his movement, which I call the social justice movement. So he's moving in that direction, right? He's saying that the residual effects of past human rights abuses in terms of slavery demand reparations from the society at large. Now, when he was asked by Jordan Peterson to define exactly what he meant by that and to how much should people of certain accomplishments fork over part of their accomplishments to the society at large or to these needy groups, Michael Dyson never really came up with an answer for that. And so it was a really great critical thinking question by Jordan Peterson, which got no really meaningful response from the people on the left or the folks that were arguing in favor of social justice or political correctness. All right. So what is the argumentation strategy of the social justice warrior? What is it? Well, let me list the things that I think are the strategy of the social justice warrior. First thing is this, and this is my take on their view. I believe their view is that reality can be viewed through the lens of materialism and class struggle, whatever that means. Therefore, class warfare and revolution is inevitable. That's what they believe. Two, materialism is the only meaningful form of expression for individuals and groups. Parenthetically, I will say, notice that they never mention innovation, ever. And keep that in mind, because that's a very, very important omission in their model of reality. I would say that the low intellectual understanding of the Industrial Revolution sees only material objects and mechanisms. And this is the mark of Marxism. A rather high intellectual understanding of industrial progress sees innovation, which is totally neglected in the neo-Marxist argument. Because collectivism or Marxism does not even entertain the idea or the existence of innovation, a socioeconomic society based upon collectivism must appropriate, either legally or illegally, innovation outside of itself. There is no mechanism by which innovation occurs within a collectivist society. And that's probably, just looking ahead here, that's probably one of the reasons why it never succeeds. While it has been tried and tried and tried, it always ends up in failure. And in my view, the reason for that is because innovation is completely neglected. And where does innovation come from? Innovation comes from the individual. Innovation is not a collectivist attribute. Innovation is the attribute of an individual. Innovation emerges from individualism, not collectivism. And I guess if I had to say that one of the most important things that I can say on this radio show, and one of the most important, if not the most important, aspect of Throttle Up is that innovation is the result of individualism, and the lack of innovation, or the status quo, is the result of collectivism. And that's the huge distinction between the two. And that pretty much explains why collectivism ultimately fails every time it is tried. And that's why individualism succeeds almost everywhere it is tried. Let me continue. With respect to collectivism and its various expressions, the spiritual realm and organized religion under such system must be ridiculed and eradicated from the social fabric. Also, under collectivism, group identity, group affiliation, and group power, meaning, I suppose, political power, is the only meaningful form of existence in the modern world. All right, that's continuing with their belief system. Individual rights are no longer needed or necessary in our postmodern world. That's pretty much what the collectivists believe. Also, they believe that animosity between certain identified groups is the best way to insert the vanguard party into the mainstream of power with the goal of power supremacy. So they're out for a power grab. That's what they're doing. While confronting opposition to neo-Marxism, the neo-Marxist proponents must, one, immediately evoke the virtue clause, which is best expressed as an unbridled concern for the poor, the disadvantaged, the dispossessed, the destitute, as well as all exploited groups. Also, they must exploit groups such as they must identify exploited groups such as shrinking middle class, minorities, women, homosexuals, the poor, and of course, children. And in addition to that, simultaneously with that, they will also identify the groups that are doing the exploitation, right? And what are these? The groups doing, in their view, in their worldview, the groups doing the exploitation are the greedy corporations, the one percenters, white males. I know, that's pretty outrageous. White males, right? And if that's not racism, I don't know what it is. The patriarchy, that's another one. Favorite one is the patriarchy. Free market capitalism is also a villain. Private ownership is also a villain in their view. Private service providers is also a villain in their view. And finally, in my list, not exclusively, but finally in my list, is private education. All right, so what are the moral and economic claims of Marxism? And this is from Stephen Hicks. Communism or socialism is morally and economically superior to capitalism, is what they believe, according to Stephen Hicks. And, by the way, let me just set this up better. Stephen Hicks is a philosopher, and he is heads up the philosophy department at Rockville University, I believe. And I think that's in Rockville, Illinois, if I'm not mistaken. And he's also a critic of neo-Marxism and postmodernism. And I would recommend his books and YouTube videos. Anyway, so he goes on to say that collectivism in the form of communism and socialism is, according to the neo-Marxist movement, is scientifically based, they believe, whereas they believe that capitalism is not scientifically based, and that's what they believe. Consequently, under capitalism, they think that the rich will get richer, and the poor will get poorer, the middle class will shrink and effectively go away. And finally, they believe that the poor will continue to be exploited. Now, I'm going to take a short break as we get ready to complete this part one, and then we'll press on to part two. Hey, welcome back to part two of Throttle Up for this week. And I wanted to just begin this discussion by something that I wanted to include in the previous discussion, but this applies to part one and part two. And so this is my take on the standard power acquisition model of neo-Marxism utilizing soft power. So if you have listened to part one, you kind of know where I'm coming from on this. And the standard power acquisition model and how they are going to acquire power in a particular political system or a particular society or country is they're going to use internal destabilization followed by power acquisition. They're going to do this by employing two activities, if you will, or two things in their arsenal. Number one is moral and economic defects, deficiencies, and abuses are highlighted. Let me say that again. They're going to highlight moral and economic defects, deficiencies, and abuses currently happening, at least they claim are currently happening in the society at large. Now, these are not necessarily, or they do not necessarily need to be backed up with any kind of objective analysis or facts or empirical evidence. They are just stated and proposed. And then this is followed by proposed remediation. They're going to propose a way to fix these problems, and they're implying here that only they have the solution, right? So they're going to propose remediation, correction, and elimination of anxiety, socioeconomic defects, and install shared prosperity within the nation. So that's the model that they use. So keep that in mind. You may want to write that down or use that to create your own model of their view of the world and how they go about doing things. Once you have that model of their reality, then you begin to put things in a more understandable perspective. You'd be able to clarify what is happening and to consider critically what is going on with respect to all of this socioeconomic agitation that is occurring. Okay, part two for this week is our storyboard. And the story is a continuing story about American politics. And I guess you could say poor or dysfunctional aspects of the American political situation. And here we're going to be talking a little bit about the FBI spying on the Trump campaign. Now, that was originally exposed, I believe, by Strassel, a gal that works for the Wall Street Journal. Anyway, it's out in the open now, the FBI spying on the Trump campaign. There's no doubt that they were doing this. Stephen Halperin was the agent, FBI agent, that was inserted into or tried to insert itself into himself into the Trump campaign to spy on it. But before we get into that, let me sort of like set the stage for this understanding, how we can understand this from a little bit broader perspective. It's not just this particular event. How does this fit into the big picture with respect to American politics? All right, so the big picture contains the following. Now, this is my list. You can create your own. But the big picture contains the following. The Trump dossier, all right, we know about that. The four FISA warrants issued with respect to Carter Page. Four FISA warrants for electronics eavesdropping or electronic spying, by the way. Russian collusion, whatever that is. The Mueller investigation. The Clinton email scandal, the Department of Justice Inspector General investigation, Comey firing, and now we have an FBI informant inserted into the Trump campaign. Now, all right, so what do we make of this? Many people are calling this the scandal of the age, and this is you could also say that this is high crimes that are occurring at the national level. Is this appropriate behavior for a government agency? Great question. Is it appropriate? So in terms of, you know, appropriateness, if we were to create what is a model of appropriate behavior, then the model must contain the following. If you're going to do this because you are concerned about America in some form or fashion, you're concerned about foreign intelligence, if you're going to do this, then you needed to do it in both campaigns, not just one. If you were doing it for reasonable, non-political purposes in one campaign, how can you justify it not being used in the other campaign? Now, here's the crux of the issue. And this is certainly, I would say, a great example of the employment of critical thinking to a complex situation. Was this informant inserted into the Trump campaign, and did he have a counterpart that was likewise inserted into the Clinton campaign? If this did not happen, then what you have here is you have a government agency performing or engaged in partisan activities in an attempt to influence the election. So while there was not necessarily foreign collusion with respect to a presidential election, there certainly was domestic collusion with respect to a presidential election. Pretty chilling. Pretty chilling. Anyway, so let me continue here. I'm gonna start to read to get more, a little bit more in depth here, and to treat it a little bit more, or to treat it in more of a meaningful way. Let me begin to read certain sections of an article in the Wall Street Journal that appeared on Monday, May 21st, and the title of the article is "Trump Demands FBI Probe." Now, President Trump, to his credit, has demanded that the Department of Justice investigate this spying scandal. So this article begins as follows, and again, this is from the Wall Street Journal. And it's written by three people, and you can look it up, you know, but I'm giving them credit here for this. And they say that the Justice Department asked its internal watchdog to examine if there was any impropriety in the counterintelligence investigation of President Donald Trump's 2016 campaign, after the president demanded Sunday that the department investigate the motives behind the inquiry. Earlier Sunday, in one of a series of tweets targeting the probe into whether Trump associates colluded with Russia during the 2016 campaign, Mr. Trump wrote, quote, "I hereby demand and will do so officially tomorrow that the Department of Justice look into whether or not the FBI DOJ infiltrated or surveilled the Trump campaign for political purposes, and if any such demands or requests were made by people within the Obama administration." Mr. Trump was referring to a man who approached at least two Trump campaign aides in 2016 in connection with counterintelligence investigations into the campaign. Special Counsel Robert Mueller took over the investigation last May when he was appointed by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. I'm continuing here with this article in the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal has identified the suspected informant as Stephen Halper, an American who was a foreign policy scholar at the University of Cambridge until 2015. Mr. Halper couldn't be immediately reached for comment. Now, this is an interesting paragraph here. I don't really quite know what to make of it, but let me read it anyway, and then we can sort of like examine it further. The article goes on to say that the journal made no agreement to withhold his name from publication and is one of several media outlets identifying him. Some lawmakers and law enforcement officials have expressed concern about compromising sources for the investigation, saying it could put lives in danger, hurt investigations, and damage international partnerships. All right, so I don't quite know what to make of that. They have inserted somebody into a political campaign, but they don't want the American people to know anything about it because it's somehow beyond the scope of public knowledge. So that just doesn't, it really doesn't pass a smell test at all. I don't know what to make of that. So let me continue here. Some person, Sarah Flores, said Sunday afternoon that the agency had asked the Inspector General to expand a probe into how the Federal Bureau of Investigation and federal prosecutors obtain warrants from the nation's secret spy court to surveil a one-time Trump campaign aide. So, in addition to this FBI informant, this FBI spy planted within the Trump administration, they are also asking for an investigation into this FISA court warrants that also gave these agencies permission to spy on American citizens. The goal here, I will continue with this article. The goal here, the spokesperson said, is to examine whether there was any impropriety or political motivation in how the FBI conducted its counterintelligence investigations of persons suspected of involvement with Russian agents during the 2016 presidential election. Mr. Rosenstein said in a statement Sunday, quote, if anyone did infiltrate or surveil participants in a presidential campaign for inappropriate purposes, we need to know about it and take appropriate action. Okay, that's a little bit understated here. We need to know about it. Why don't you already know about it? So that, you see, that doesn't make any sense. If this was secret information that should not be revealed to the public, then the agency knew and was containing this. So that, you know, none of this stuff makes any sense. I don't get it. Sorry. It just doesn't make sense to me. Let me continue with this article. The move by the Deputy Attorney General to follow an extraordinary order by the president to probe an investigation into his own campaign is the latest turn in a struggle between the White House and the Justice Department. This is from the Wall Street Journal's article. I will continue to quote here. Mr. Trump has more than once considered firing Mr. Rosenstein and Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who have survived in their roles in part by meeting the demands of the president or his supporters in Congress. Mr. Rosenstein oversees the Russia investigation. All right. So I don't know what to make of that, except for the fact that this is another blooming political scandal on top of political scandals. And where will it end? There clearly is was and maybe still is a concerted effort to destabilize and to denigrate and render inoperative the Trump presidency. Why is that? Well, again, we don't, at least I don't know everything that's going on, but we don't know a lot about it, and we need to get to the bottom of it. All right, so that is the conclusion of part two, at least so far. I'm sure we'll talk more about it on other shows. So let us press on to part three. We only have a few minutes left, but I do want to introduce some more thoughts on part three. And welcome back to part three of Throttle Up for this week. Part three is a discussion, well, it's a radio essay, and it's a continuing discussion of what we are beginning our talk about, complex problem solving. And we began this discussion, I believe it was last week. We're going to continue for quite some time because it is a very interesting subject, and I think it's very useful for all of us. And I have a good time preparing for it and discussing it. And this is something that is sort of like near and dear to my heart because I've been involved in it for a long time. Anyway, complex problem solving, the number one sought after skill in the global job market. Critical thinking now is number two. Complex problem solving is number one. And of course, the big question is, why is that? How did this happen? What occurred to make this now the number one sought after skill in the global job market? Great question. And we're going to be talking about that in the weeks ahead. But let me just give you a few things to consider as we prepare this this continuing discussion. The first thing to consider is, what exactly is a problem? No, we all know what a problem is. No, we don't. All right. No, that's a misnomer. Not necessarily. Number two, how did it happen? How did this problem happen? What is the occurrence by which the problem was made manifest? The occurrence could be a serious event. And of course, was the problem, or has the problem been clarified? The clarification of the problem. All problems need to be clarified. We don't assume that we understand them. And how do we clarify a problem? We clarify a problem by creating what I call a formalized problem definition. And so keep that in mind. The problem definition becomes a really, that's one of the golden rules of problem solving, is to first and foremost have a clearly defined definition of the problem that we are facing. Okay, so we are now at the conclusion of another Throttle Up. I have enjoyed it quite a bit. And I would like to thank my audience for tuning in once again to Throttle Up or to downloading the podcast. Thank you. Again, we are on every weekend on Red State Talk Radio. I'd like to thank Red State Talk Radio for providing us with this opportunity. And also, as we approach Memorial Day, thank you all of you veterans, and thank you for your service. And also those on active duty in the Guard and Reserve, thank you for serving. And I can see by the clock on the wall that we are now at the end of this show, and we will be back next week.